Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Welcome to Orange Ribbon on Joy 94.9 today with Hal and me, Alan. In today's program, we chat to a man who was born on the tiny island of Mauritius, but who moved to Australia when he was just 3 years old. Michael was a really interesting story to tell, from his home life of being school captain, sports interest, university, and then being a child carer for 7 years. These days, Michael works in events management, and we'll cover a little of that occupation as well. As usual, we've got another interesting chat coming up on Orange Ribbon today. Please stay with us for the next hour here on Joy 94.9. Welcome to Orange Ribbon, Joy 94.9's multicultural program, and it's with Hal and me. Hello, Hal.
Hi, Alan, and hello to everyone out there.
People are not used to us being on Saturdays because we have been on Wednesdays for so long, but this is our second edition of Orange Ribbon on a Saturday afternoon.
Yes, so. And have we got a show for you out there? Tonight we've got a very... this afternoon we have a special
guest. You've got so used to being Wednesday nights. We're not Wednesday nights.
I keep on talking about night time. So anyway, today, this afternoon, we've got a very special guest, Michael. Michael was originally born in Mauritius, but he came to Australia when he was three. And so he's got a very full life in Australia that will be a very interesting topic for us to cover. And also another thing that's close to my heart, he's also a St. Albans boy, which is what I am. I grew up in St. Albans as well. So
when did you come to Australia then? How long ago?
1969, actually. So when I was 3 years old.
My goodness. Oh, we can all do maths now, can't we?
I didn't say that, did I?
No. Why did the family come to Australia from Mauritius?
I think it was probably just that big immigration push back then, and plus my father had worked overseas in Britain, and so had seen that kind of lifestyle. And I think a lot of Mauritians were, you know, emigrating at that time, mainly to Canada and so forth. And so Australia it was.
But do you know why Australia? If he'd already been to Britain, I would have thought the first reaction would be to go back there.
The climate.
Oh.
It was those cold, cold winters in Britain that was probably something that he didn't want to, you know, involve his family in. So decided Australia, being a temperate sort of climate,
Melbourne is like, even though we keep on slagging off our weather, is still better than England or the whole of Britain.
Definitely, definitely, yes. Well, Mauritius is like about as tropical as Cairns, so I don't know why we chose Melbourne, but anyway...
Well, so you lived in St. Albans all your life, or all your childhood anyway?
No, not really. Basically just an inner city boy. We arrived in Windsor, and we lived with a Greek family. So we arrived here on a Greek passenger ship. So
I never thought about that. You even came by ship, not
yes,
by air.
Yes, that's correct,
goodness,
yeah.
That's going back a little while.
And there are crazy pictures of my parents, like with little party hats on and having a great time on board the ship. So, yeah, it was just like a cruise, I guess. But I suppose back in those days, people cruised in order to get somewhere rather than just cruising around, you know, like the Caribbean and so forth.
Mm. Mm. What are your early recollections as a child here, given that... as we look at you, you're obviously coloured skin, which means you would stand out a little bit, even, I presume, in a place like St. Albans, even at that stage. Mm. Did you have any problems with racism and comments?
There was, I guess, from a young age, there was always a point of difference because you appeared different to everybody else. However... having entered the school system already from a young age and gone to kindergarten and so forth, there was already that assimilation. So the fact is that you were just like any other kids who were called any other name. So, I mean, the WOG kids got called WOGs and so forth. And so there was that sort of thing.
I mean, is this at St. Albans at the time? Because, I mean, I guess based on my experience of St. Mm-hmm. Albans, it's actually... St. Albans is a very diverse group of people. Mm. And so... being different is actually being normal when it's like there's one Aussie kid in my school in my year level or something, and she stand out like a sore thumb, so to speak.
So it was normal to be abnormal, if we could sort of put it in there.
That's a bit controversial for you to say that, Alan. I think it has such a diverse group of different culture there. It's a bit of mishmash of different people that being different is not really something that stands out, I think.
I would agree with that, yes, because being different means being normal, and if you're not different, then there's something wrong with you.
Did you or did your family retain any of your Mauritian culture at all, as in festivals and whatever, or did you sort of push all of that aside over time?
Well, I think that the Mauritian culture is quite a melting pot. It's quite further down the track than what Australia is, so there's a lot of different cultures there, so everything from Chinese to Indian to Muslims to French people and Portuguese and Africans, so there's a real mishmash of it. So having said that, I mean, I came from a sort of strict Judeo-Christian background, so Roman Catholic, the whole thing, so there wasn't, we just observed the same sort of, religious rituals as everyone else. So culturally, I think it only stuck in the food and stuff like that mainly, not in anything else. So
it's like, you know, when you say you're Roman Catholic, so would you have gone to like a normal, an Australian Roman Catholic church rather than like there wasn't like a specific Mauritius?
No. Well, see, when I was old enough to go to primary school, I went to, I think it was St. John's in Richmond, and then St. Joseph's in Collingwood as well, so with all the nuns and everything else like that. So it was that kind of upbringing. So very, very typical.
So it was a fairly religious family that you were brought up in. Have you retained that, or have you sort of become a sort of non-practicing Catholic these days?
Well, my family's still very, very religious. I mean, my mother has a glow-in-the-dark Virgin Mary on her arm. It's a huge one, and she gets water from Lourdes, you know, trucked in practically, but where the crown comes off, and it's quite strange.
The crown
comes off the top of the Mary, and
is this
the water.
Like the halo?
No, there's a crown. Yes, and there's water from Lourdes in there. But all that, look, my parents are still religious at the moment, you know, still, so they're, and my sister is, so she's younger than me, but I think at about 17, 18, I was too busy, when I was at church, too busy checking out the guys. So it was like, I kept thinking, oh, I'll get, you know, some sort of like, you know, lightning strike or something. But, I sort of slowly but surely just
drifted away,
yes. Mm. And kept certain things as well.
That's your parent actually want, like, keep asking you or hassling you to go back to church or something like that?
No, not at all. No. Okay. So that was a decision that we sort of made, all the kids, so there was no pressure.
You mentioned your sister, so you obviously have a sister. Do you have other siblings as well?
I have a younger sister and I have an older brother, both married with children, very typical, just a regular kind of...
You're a middle child.
I'm the middle problem child, the black sheep of the family, so...
What were your ambitions as a child, say in teenage, what did you want to do as once you grew up? What were your objectives?
To get through it all.
Is that all?
Oh, no. I mean, it was interesting because I went to an interesting high school and so forth because the area that I lived in was being redeveloped and so forth, and so we were zoned in. So when I was in high school, there was only us. There's only 40 students. Then when we went to second level up, there was the next one. So it was quite unique. So I sort of excelled in a lot of things. So I did sport. I was school captain. I was the student rep on the council. So there was never anyone above us, older than us, to sort of learn from. So we just did whatever we wanted. And as I grew up and went to sixth form, it was like we were always told you could do whatever you wanted. So
that's pretty good.
So, always been in communication and all that sort of stuff. So I never really, my vocation was to become a teacher, but that sort of fell by the side, amongst other things.
You mentioned that, you mentioned you first came to Australia, you live in Windsor, and then going to school in Richmond, and I've already told everyone that you're a St. Albans boy.
Yes, of course.
So that's already a free suburb you've lived in when you're growing up. Mm-hmm. I mean, is it very different? I mean, like this moving, like do you have to like find new friends every time you move to a different suburb, or do you be able to keep all your friends along the way?
Well, I was quite young when we got to St. Albans. That was in 1975, so we'd already moved a couple of times, but my family had still family friends, so there was communication there with the other Mauritians and so forth. But in regards to moving on from there, no, there has been no problem, because I lived in St Albans for until 86, and then I lived at uni and then moved to St Kilda.
This is On Driven. You're with Harold and Alan, and our guest in the studio today is Michael.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Orange Ribbon with Hal and Alan. This afternoon, we've got Michael in here with us talking about growing up in Australia, and he's from Mauritius originally. Moving on from our last segment, you mentioned that you've got a quite a committed Roman Catholic family. How does that affect your coming out process?
It really didn't. Look, my background for my parents is that my mother was going to become a teacher, and so we learnt English, and my father, obviously, you know, lived in England for a number of years, and so it was big in our household to always talk and always read and so forth. Mm-hmm. So because of that strong background, from a young age, I'd gone to the library, and when I sort of had this inkling that, oh, I think I'm a bit different, I started reading up about it. And so that, okay. So there was an acceptance to, you know, with myself and so forth. So I guess I knew what Christianity thought of it and so forth, even at the age of 12.
Right. Is that the age where you realised there was something different, or is it even earlier than that?
I can trace back earlier, but self-realisation, definitely by 12.
How did you deal with it in the early teen years? Because I guess they're the difficult years. Some guys are brave enough to really come out at that stage, but others, I guess most, tend to hide it for a few more years while they sort of feel their way sort of thing. How did you deal with it in those early years?
I personally, it was about the reading and about the finding out and so forth. And because I was like school captain and all that sort of thing on the sports team and everything, it was all, there was a distraction. So everyone saw me, but nobody actually saw me. So I just sort of went under the radar with it all, basically.
I mean, and because you're saying that you're school captain and all that, so in some way you're kind of like top of the food chain
sort of thing.
So nobody can, you know, try and like bully you or harass you or anything like that regarding those.
But it's more pressure, though. Wouldn't that be more pressure on? Because you're really trying to keep up an image that people expect of you in those roles.
Definitely. But this is where the paradox is, I guess. It's because I was so different. I was different to a lot of people that we didn't have many other coloured people in the school, for example. So being so different, it was like anything I did was different anyway. So he didn't have a girlfriend. Yeah, well, that's
just
him.
Roll that all into that Mauritius thing.
Exactly, that whole exotic thing or whatever it is. So it was quite, it was strange. I look back on it now and I do believe it is quite strange. And obviously not having anyone older around in high school, there's no one pressuring you saying, oh, you know, like, you know, bullying you and so forth. So there was none of that. So I was never questioned.
So at what stage did you finally come out to somebody? And who was that? Was it a friend or a family, or how did it happen?
That was in high school, and I was about 17 at the time, so that was with a close friend of mine who I'd been friends with from about when I was 11 or 12. So that's how that transpired. So I was in HSC at the time.
Right.
Male or female?
A female.
What was the reaction?
Is that all? Oh. She's still my friend now, so this is like 20-odd years later, whatever it is, 30 years later, yeah.
So, but did that actually give you the confidence to come out to more people because she had such a blasé kind of reaction to the whole thing?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I didn't come out to my family till I was 22, so I was at university, so that was a few years
later. So by that time, you already moved out of home?
Yes, I'd moved out in 86, so I was living at the university then.
How did things develop after that? I mean, we're talking about mid-80s period, I guess.
That's correct.
The gay scene wouldn't be all that developed around Melbourne at that stage. So what did you do? Where did you go? I mean, I know there were some places around from the 60s and 70s, of which a couple of which I sort of recall.
Now, showing your age again, Alan.
About that. But, I mean, nevertheless, in the 80s, there really wouldn't be an awful lot to choose from.
No, there wasn't really when it came to socialising and so forth, but things were starting. So through support groups, like, through Also and so forth. And there were a couple of other little ones as well. So you could find it at the... It's called the International Bookshop or something. I was there one day and I saw a little flyer for a first step program, just a group that was run out of, I think it was Ross House
in Flinders Lane.
Yes. And so there was various community groups there. And so one of them was a gay and lesbian one, and that's how I got involved in that.
Was there any, like, gay and lesbian group at university that...
There was a gay soc, yes, but it was all... It seemed a bit... Yeah, I don't know. It was just unattainable. I don't know, I just... It was a bit hard to get to go to that one because it just seems...
It's too close-knit.
Too close,
people in
yes.
there too clingy and if...
Or too radical, perhaps, even?
As well, yes, because it all became a bit... It was very political back then, back in the 80s as well, so I guess it was just not accessible, whereas I found this other one outside was a lot easier to go to. You go to on the weekends and so forth, and you'd socialise and mix with others.
Do you remember your first attendance at that group and what you felt walking in the door, or did you walk up and down outside a few times?
I just charged in like a bull in a china shop. It was amazing. It was because I'd seen the flyer and I thought, I've got to do this. And so when I did approach the group, I just walked straight in, and it was just, it was very welcoming, and it was just absolutely fantastic. And
how many were there?
Probably about 15, and it was a mixture of guys and girls.
And cultures?
Yes, different. There was a few, like, so a lot of Aussies, and then there was, a couple of Italians and so forth.
I mean, was this... I'm showing my lack of gay history here, but was this at the height of the whole AIDS epidemic at the time, or was it something...
It would have been, exactly. I mean, those ads and that we all know about, the Grim Reaper and stuff, were a few years before that. So this was just at the time of, the general community was just all, sort of in awe of, like, what was happening anyway, and it was the gay disease and so forth. So it was quite difficult to actually come out at that age, because, I mean, I was 20-something at the time, so...
What about you said you didn't come out to your family till, I think you said, till you were about 22 or something or other, which again would be at the height of all of this, and I guess when you do come out, the first thing that's going to jump into their heads is this whole Grim Reaper and all that sort of thing.
That's right.
How was that for you at the time?
When I came out to my mother, the first thing she said, I've got to go and peel some prawns. That's what she said. That's what she said. It was like... Look, my family, I guess, because I didn't grow up with an extended family, so no uncles, aunties and so forth, we were very sort of close, and might I say that probably the most important thing in a family is to sit down and have dinner. And so we did that a lot, and I suppose there was a communication, a good communication sort of level established there. And
so did you, like, break it down to, you spoke to your mum first?
That's correct.
It wasn't, like, announced at the dinner table to everyone?
No.
Kind of thing.
That's right. And then when, I told my dad and my brother and sister, it was just strange, because it wasn't talked about then. That was basically what happened. It just wasn't talked about. So there was, so that just sort of went dormant for a few years, and that was it. So
you've had partners along the way,
Yes.
And what's the family reaction to you introducing partners?
My siblings are a lot more accepting, but now that we're all in our 40s, it's like no one cares anymore. No one sort of, like, we, and I think because our family unit was so small, but now it's all split up now because everyone's married and so forth.
Except for you.
I'm single. But the thing is, it's just that because of the separation and all that, there hasn't been much discussion on that.
Okay. We'll come back and talk about the gay scene further. You're listening to Orange Ribbon.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
Manhattan Transfer and Chanson d'Amour, and all of the music in today's program has been chosen by our guest Michael. And coming up after this break and messages from our sponsors, another song, French song by Edith Piaf, the very well-known Non, je ne regrette rien. You're listening to Orange Ribbon on Joy 94.9.
Made in Melbourne, for the world.
Joy 94.9.
Orange Ribbon with Alan and Howe, and our guest in on the program today is Michael of Mauritian background. Now, you sort of alluded earlier that you went along to the Ross House in Flinders Lane, I think it is, and got involved in a group, but you've been involved in various groups since then, support groups and doing various volunteer community work. How did that progress? Why did you start getting involved in more volunteer work?
I guess it was just to have a first-hand experience with the gay community, and of course there's the nightclubbing and so forth, which I was doing anyway, but I just wanted a different dimension, a different place to meet more like-minded people and same-sex-oriented people as well. So that's where that came from.
What sort of groups did you go on and do a time with? Volunteer time, I mean.
Basically through the Victorian AIDS Council, you know, back in the 80s and early 90s, just with their coming out programs and projects as well. Also with Ross House, with the First Step program, I used to conduct them at the St Kilda Library, and that was fantastic. So I've actually met a few friends who I'm still friends with now. Then I moved on then to the Also Foundation, so working with community development, so doing outreach work to various universities and colleges and also community groups.
So you've got your fingers in a lot of pies.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
In doing some of that outreach work, I mean, we were just chatting off air, you haven't done the beach thing, as in distributing information or whatever at the beach, have you, or not?
No, I haven't done that kind of outreach work at all, so it's mainly just, as I mentioned, just going to the universities and clubs and societies that sort of all contribute to the, like, the Also directory, those kind of groups.
Why do you do it? What do you get out of it?
I just enjoy, I guess, just meeting a lot of different people. It's like I've always said, like, for example, the Midsummer Carnival Day is probably one of my favourite events on the gay calendar, because you just see people that you just don't see any other time, and that's just fantastic, because it really establishes within me anyway the ideal that, God, we're all so different, and there is an opportunity to meet different people and link up with them. Mm. So it's a huge, huge melting pot.
I must admit, it's like, you know, volunteering for the Midsummer Carnival. I've actually met a couple of friends who are still friends with me after all these years, and it is actually a great opportunity. It's like volunteering at Joy is a fantastic opportunity to meet people. That's a bit of advertising there for our listeners. But you do get a lot of, like, satisfaction and out of being involved with the community. And mm-hmm. is there any negative aspects that you can see, or that it's all pretty much positive?
I think it's like anything that you do in life. It's if you get involved in things, you're always going to get involved in the good aspects and the bad aspects. So the bad aspects, I guess, in any kind of community, is like you get a lot of people who are negative on certain things. So you present a program, you present an idea, and it's just like, well, we can't do that, we can't do this, and so forth. So that always happens everywhere. But that's good anyway, because it gives people an opportunity to sort of talk.
Yeah. What about reaction to, if you're out doing outreach programs, do you get any negative reaction yourself personally because of your appearance? I mean, given that we've already explained that you're coloured,
yes,
in appearance,
yes,
do you get any negatives from that at all?
No, there really hasn't been. I mean, you get it, I guess, from different places and so forth. It's mainly like, I remember back in the 80s, it was quite a bit different to what it is now. And there's a lot more diversity now and a lot more acceptance, because people know a lot more through the internet and all the information, superhighway and all that sort of stuff. But back then, people didn't, you know, you were a bit different. You know, you were the coloured guy at the nightclub who danced, did the go-go dancing, and it's like, oh, he's pretty exotic, he's pretty different. It's like, so there was that aspect of it.
Okay, can I just lower the tone down? Did it help you to, in terms of getting a lot more.
Picking up, yeah.
I was going to ask the same question.
It actually, yes, I guess it did, because I've done a lot of those podium dancing sort of routines over the years. It did, yes. But I think it's all to do with the person themselves as well and how confident you are. So my experience has been pretty much positive.
Yeah, that's good.
What are you currently involved in? Are you involved in any particular activities or volunteer activities and groups at the moment, or are you giving it a rest?
Not at the moment, no. I still keep tabs on things, so yeah. Because I still know a few people in both Victorian AIDS Council and also as well. So I keep a close ear to the community. And also, like, with mainly parties and things like that, so that side of things, but not too much in the sort of community development side.
Talking about parties and things, you've already alluded to the fact more than once that you're either in your 40s or we can do the sums and work it out. Do you find that your approach to life, your approach to being involved in the gay scene, is changing as you get older? I mean, how often do you go to discos now? Are you still regularly go, or do you find you're slowing down a little?
Slow down a lot. I'd be lucky to go about 3 times in a year. However, having said that, because I know a lot of people in the industry from having worked at various warehouse parties and various parties like that, you still keep tabs on things. So you actually go to the choice events. But, I mean, I come from a culture that, you know, like, gay culture, that is, they used to call it Rawhide, and it was a men only. And then there was a WOW party, which is women only parties. That was back in the 80s. And so then there was the amalgamation and then the whole explosion of the warehouse party scene. And then, of course,
down at Shed 7 at
Shed 14 and everything.
Shed 14, whatever it was, yeah.
That's right, yes.
Does it still exist? I mean, I thought the whole Dockland is being completely cleared up now, isn't it?
I think
it?
The shed is still there, but it's used for something else.
It's now a function venue called Atlantic.
Is that what it is?
Yes, and if you go in there, you can still see the remnants of the old party. Think, oh my God, what was I doing at that time?
With those ultraviolet lights and shine it around.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
Yes, I have been known to go to a couple of parties there, maybe in the early 90s. I think early mid-90s, I think, is probably the last time I went there.
Yes.
A bit too old for them.
I was just going to say that, just to tie it all back in here, my father used to work for the Port of Melbourne Authority, and a funny story, one day I came home from one of these parties, and it was in the evening, and I was visiting my parents at the time, and he said, "You know what, I saw all these people in weird outfits coming from one of those," and I thought, oh my God, I hope he didn't see me anyway.
Anyway, this is Orange Ribbon, and we're speaking to Michael, who comes from Mauritius Joy 94.9 with Hal and Alan.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Orange Ribbon with Hal and Alan, and we've got Michael with us today.
We're going to talk about perceptions. We were just chatting off-air about the issue of dealing with people on the phone, and I gather perhaps you've had a few situations where people have dealt with you on the phone for a period of time before they actually physically meet you. What's the reaction when they see you?
Like, it's quite funny, actually, because I've grown up here and I've got that sort of, g'day mate, Aussie accent kind of thing going on. It's just that sometimes I sort of slip into that, and yeah, I've had numerous meetings with people, because I work in the event industry, and so you have a lot of pre-meetings over the phone, and then when they meet you, they go, oh, right, I thought you were going to be 6 foot tall and blonde and white. And it's like, no, someone that ain't me.
Yeah, someone walking out of Neighbours episode.
That's right, yeah. Absolutely.
Mm. Have you had some funny experiences along those lines? Some unusual things have happened, unusual reactions when they've seen you?
That's probably been the most unusual, because they've come into the venue and they're all sort of stressed out and so forth, and so they're expecting someone, and it's just not working for them that you look like the way that you look. So they're quite surprised by it.
So it's like they stress about something else and then add you to the mix. It kind of just completely flustered them up.
Definitely. And then they ask you, so what's your background, where you come from, and so say, for God, you sound so Australian. And it's like, you know, you speak English very well. And I say, well, I should. I've lived here for over 40 years. It's like, you know. So that's the only, you know, sort of funny aspect. But there's numerous amounts of those same situations that occur just over and over and over again.
Do you ever get the to the point where you just, every time someone have that reaction, you just roll your eyes and just... just like that.
No, I just say, oh, no, I just say, no, he's not here. He's not here. So I've come in his place, so it's going to have to put up with me, unfortunately.
Is there a non-answer, I suppose, but is there any difference between the way you are reacted to in the workplace after having dealt with you on the phone versus maybe dealing with people on the phone in the gay community, or is there no real difference?
I don't think there's much of a difference. If it's going to happen, it's going to happen in any kind of sort of area. And I have had that situation occur like a few times. So people have been quite surprised when they've met me. So after having spoken to me, I guess, you know, over the years I've just gotten so used to it that I leave it as is. But I do, I'm aware of it because I can pick up now with other people if they're from a different culture and, you know, like gay, straight or whatever kind of thing, you know. So I can sort of pick up there's a slight accent there, you know, with a lot of people. So you become a lot more aware of it.
Now, you mentioned that you're involved in events coordination.
Mm-hmm.
What does that involve? I mean, what do you actually have to do to plan an event, and what types of events would you be planning?
Oh, everything, actually. I've actually done a couple of midsummer openings at the venue that I work at, and so we've had huge parties there. So we do everything from cocktail parties of 1,000 right down to symposiums and small functions like that, breakfast lunches and so forth. Like, I've got to get up tomorrow morning at 4 a.m. to go to work. So that's the kind of thing that I do. So a lot of people contact and...
Do you have to, have to get into this kind of, like, putting out fires, kind of emergency mode, like, trying to...
Oh, definitely.
Things didn't get delivered on time
absolutely.
Or the chairs were set up wrongly or...
Yes. It's the wrong colour flowers on the centrepiece.
Definitely. Look, I over the years I've learnt not to switch on the panic gene. I don't possess it for some reason. I have no idea why. So it just works, and I have this calming ability with everyone. So I say, sure.
It's interesting you say that, because I don't know how many people watched the Winter Olympics opening the other night, or the other week, whenever it was, a few weeks ago now, where the four poles that were supposed to come up during the opening ceremony for the flame, and only three came up.
Yes.
And a very similar thing happened, as we all remember, at the Summer Olympics in Sydney when the bowl stuck.
That's right, it stuck
all because of a 20-cent solenoid or something.
Yes. Well, you get used to it, though. You get used to all those kind of situations, but it's a matter of just taking control, and that's what it's
and
all
I think,
about.
And I think you have that personality to do that. You know, you don't have that, like, that panic gene, which I know I have. So I know I probably, in that sort of situation, I'll probably be really stressed out and really high-strung, and I'll be, like, running around like a headless chook, you're very chill and calm.
You learn to be like that. I mean, one interesting aspect was like when I used to be a childcare worker, so I worked with 0 to 5-year-olds, and I did that for 7 years. And it's interesting to see parents' reaction to see a coloured male, you know, looking after their children. So from that age, when I was younger, when I was working, you know, I learned to sort of like be calm about a lot of things and people's reactions, and you watch people's reactions, and you learn how to. It's going to probably, you know, get me in a lot of trouble here, but you learn how to manipulate people. Now I've let out my secret, everyone's going to know.
but it's interesting, yes. You said as a childcare worker, because that's interesting from a number of aspects, but particularly because of this perception in a lot of people's minds that if this male childcare worker turns up, he might be a pedophile or something like that.
Yes.
I mean, you must have to work very hard to subtly allay those sorts of those fears and concerns.
Definitely, yes. I mean, it's all about image building. That's what it's all about. You have to present a certain image, and it was interesting because it's like, I know a lot of people, you know, like gay people have to present a certain persona in their work environment and so forth. Mm. I was out only to the coordinator of the centre, but the other workers I wasn't. So, and that was to keep it all to a minimum because parents were quite, you know, jumpy about things like that.
And I guess with parents as well is that they can be a very unreasonable or they are completely irrational
people
that you can't actually talk to them yes. in a logical manner, because it's their kid, and so it's like logic just goes out the door, and they've
definitely
got,
and like, it's hard actually. It's hard when you get feedback from the parents when they come in and they say, oh, little Johnny just said, you know, at home, oh, I hate you, I like Michael better. And you're like, oh, okay, what am I saying in this situation, you know? So it's just, you know, so there's a lot of watching of yourself and how you're perceived and what you how you appear to be. And so also come from, like, a different cultural background. It's like, okay, I mean, because you're so different. And, of course, and there's the other thing that works in... against you. There's a reverse sexism that works in childcare centres if you're a male, because it's always like, oh, you're just a guy, you just sit down and just do the activities, and or just go out and play with the kids, because you can't do the other sort of stuff. So there's, you know...
How long did you do this for?
Seven years.
7 years?
Goodness. So 0 to 5 year olds, and I trained as well for 2 years to work with the babies as well, so...
Does it completely satiate your appetite for children, and you'd never want to have any children now?
I am over it. And the thing that I love the most is that I do look after kids every now and then, like my friend's kids, and they say, you know what? This is yours. You can take it
you
now.
You can have it back now.
Yes.
Well, anyway, look, we're getting a little bit short of time, so maybe we'll give a wind-up there. So thanks very much, Michael, for coming in. It's been a very interesting chat. And all the very best for your subsequent events. Hope no major traumas occur.
No, well, thank you very much. No, it'll be fine. You just have to just keep your head still and just sort of say, yeah, sure, no problem. But that translates to something else. I think you all know what that means.
We've been speaking with Michael, who's been in Australia basically all of his life, but who moved from Mauritius at the age of 3. That's Orange Ribbon for another week. Our thanks to Michael for taking time out today to have a chat with us. It's always very interesting to hear about the lives of those who come from a culture other than that of a typical Australian, even if he was actually raised in Australia and therefore seen to be fully Australian. Thanks to Adrian out on Joy's reception for helping out this afternoon. Coming up next on Joy is Women's Zone with Paz, so stay tuned for that. Thanks for joining Hal and I on Orange Ribbon today. Orange Ribbon will be back again at the same time, 2 o'clock next Saturday afternoon, for more insights into our LGBTIQ community here in Melbourne and in Australia and around the world. That's all for today. I'm Alan Smales. Until next Saturday, bye for now.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.